Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at commonwealthclub.org on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I'm journalist Jonathan Curiel, your moderator for today's program called Bridging Islam and the West. And I want to introduce our esteemed speaker, Carla Power. Those of you who know Carla will know that she's a Pulitzer Prize finalist. And she's a journalist specializing in Muslim societies. And she's the author of the critically acclaimed and Pulitzer Prize finalist book, If the Oceans Were Ink, An Unlikely Friendship and a Journey to the Heart of the Quran. This book is an account of her year spent studying with Islamic scholar Sheikh Mohammed Akram Nadwi and the candid conversations they shared about the Quran, its misconceptions, and the bridging of Islam in the Western world. It offers a look into the Muslim world that's often ignored by our news media, and it explores the many complexities of one of the world's most misunderstood regions. She currently writes for Time Magazine and other publications and is a former correspondent for Newsweek. Her essays have appeared in a wide range of publications from Vogue, Oprah Magazine, New York Times Magazine, The Guardian, and Foreign Policy. Carla holds degrees from St. Anthony's College at Oxford University, Yale, and Columbia, and she currently lives in England. We are extremely pleased she's joined us tonight at the Commonwealth Club of California. So please join me in welcoming Carla Power. I'm really happy you're here. I'm excited to talk to you about a really important subject. And the book I read over the last couple days, it's an extremely incredible book about your friendship with Sheikh Mohammed Akram Nadwi. Can you talk, just if you don't mind setting the stage, about why you wrote the book, what makes you the person to write the book, and really a little bit maybe about the Sheikh Mohammed Akram, who you go by. He goes by Akram in your book, by the way.
Akram, or I call him the Sheikh.
Okay,
so
yeah.
There was talk for a while that we were going to call the book The Sheikh and I, but my publishers nixed it, so but I kind of secretly wanted it to be called The Sheikh and I. But anyway, I'll start back in my childhood. I grew up half the time in the Midwest and half the time in the Middle East and other Islamic countries. So I spent my childhood sort of shuttling between suburban St. Louis and places like Tehran and Kabul and Cairo and Delhi. So I got interested in Islamic issues sort of aesthetically, and then went on to study them, and then went on to write as a journalist about them. As a journalist, I was incredibly frustrated because as much as I tried to write about Muslim societies, I found that the narratives sort of bifurcated into one of two. One was I was writing about strong men with Kalashnikovs and bombs, or muffled and oppressed women. And those were the two tropes that I inevitably would get written about. That was it when I was writing news stories. When I went on to feature stories, it slightly widened. I was able to write about things like Pakistani punk rock bands or halal energy drinks or Muslim European professionals. And that gave a little bit more bandwidth to the terrorism and, you know, veiled woman narratives. But even then, I felt it was kind of like, instead of saying Muslims, they're the other, it was Muslims, they're just like us. And it sort of reminded me of those magazines you see at the checkout in the supermarket, where, you know, it's sort of like, you know, movie stars, they're just like us. You know, there's Angelina Jolie with a baby on her hip and a latte and you know, and there was never any opportunity to sort of excuse oneself from this like different shuttle. You were either, you know, looking into the abyss or looking into a hall of reflecting mirrors where, you know, you wanted to see Muslims looking exactly like the rest of us, sort of thing. And to really, really delve down and take a Muslim's worldview on their own terms. There wasn't room or space in mainstream, even long form media. So, and I also should say that never in 17 years of writing about Islam was I asked about the Quran. Mm. We tend as secular journalists or journalists who are mostly covering things as secularists, whether we are or not, we tend to overlook the scripture that is ostensibly animating or at least started all of this. So I had a friend, this was in 2011, who I had worked with as a young woman, Sheikh Muhammad Akram Nadwi. I had met him when I was 24, and he was barely older than I was. He was an Indian sheikh. He was the rising star of his own madrasa in Lucknow in India, and had been sent to Oxford to work at the same think tank that I was working on. We were sort of polite friends. But then in 2012, I asked him, would it be okay if I shadowed you and really, really tried to understand what your worldview is based on the Quran and the Hadith, the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad? So this meant a year of conversations on everything from sex to hell to jihad to how to raise kids to geopolitics. And he let me trail him to his hometown in India and to the gym and to up and down the UK on lecture tours. And it really was an attempt to kind of map where my worldview. I was raised by a Quaker father and a Jewish mother, both of whom were lapsed. And I was raised sort of as a secular humanist. And he was this very conservatively trained scholar. And I wanted to see what brought us together and where our views diverged. And so that was the template.
And you hinted a very important point of the year-long interview, and that is he's a very complex person with, like a lot of us, full of contradictions,
sure,
but often, like a lot of us, full of humor. and you bring out not only the Quran's humanity in a way, but you bring out his humanity, very, very nicely. Can you talk about that kind of contradiction and how, in a sense, here's the gold mine you've been waiting for, not just a superficial they are like us, but a, well, on the one hand this, on the other hand this. And you put yourself in the book and you say at one point, well, I was a little bit loath to hear what he said about, you know, gays and lesbians. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But can you talk about that, just how he, in a sense, was the ideal cleric?
Well, I mean, he's extraordinarily interesting. I mean, he was raised, in a tiny, tiny village, and reading by kerosene lamp, reading Persian poets and the Quran, and then because of his brilliance, by 17 he had already written a grammar in Arabic or on Arabic grammar, even though he grew up speaking Urdu, the Indian Muslim language, as well as Hindi and all sorts of other languages. So he started out from this tremendously rural, taking the buffaloes to be watered in the evening and reading by kerosene light at night. But in many ways, he's far more cosmopolitan than I am. I mean, when I started seeing the layers and layers of what a cosmopolitan alim, in a religious scholar, has at his disposal, he is linked into a network of religious scholars. Whenever we hear network these days linked to Islam, we all immediately freeze and think it's Al-Qaeda or something else. But of course, he is part of a global network of intensely learned folks who are not involved in politics and yet who help each other out on texts and so on. So whenever I went any place, he would send me, I'd be like, oh yeah, I'm going to India. He's like, are you going to Jaipur? Because I need to get a certificate of learning from a scholar in Jaipur. Could you go get that for me? And he collects these sort of ijazas, which are certificates of learning from other scholars, the way you would go and pick up a Yankees cap if you went to New York with a friend, and so this very cosmopolitan view of the world that comes not through, you know, having traveled 37 countries in a year or whatever, but instead from being linked through scholarship.
And one of the points that is really relevant and timely, and I'm so glad this is a part of your book, is his views on women in Islam. Mm. That's a controversial touch point for Muslims and non-Muslims alike. It's become a political touchstone. I believe he has six daughters.
He has six daughters.
But more, you know, as importantly to note is that he's written. He's the first scholar to write about hidden women in Islam, 9,000, upwards of 9,000?
10,000 now.
10,000, okay.
He came from an incredibly conservative, in terms of gender politics. His family was so conservative that daughters and fathers, after daughters reach adolescence, try not to speak to one another. They observe parda in such strict ways that brothers and sisters after adolescence will not talk to one another. So it's a very, I'm pretty sure I was the first, you know, American that he was friends with, but I'm sure I was the first woman that he spoke to freely outside the madrasa because they weren't allowed. So he comes from this very constricted notion of what is right and proper. That said, I call him the accidental feminist because one day about 15 years ago, he sat me down. He's like, Carla, I'm working on something that you'll be interested in. I know you're interested in women's issues. I'm going to do something on women scholars of hadith, of the words and deeds of the Prophet Muhammad. And he's like, you know, it'll be a slim volume. It'll be maybe 20 or 30 scholars because there are some very, very well-known erudite women stretching back to the times of the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century. And people know of them, and a couple of scholars have written on them before, but in English, and I'm sure more have written in other languages. But he started going, and he was looking in the margins of all sorts of other forms of books. He was looking in travel books. He was looking in lists at the end of mosque and madrasa, lists of who had studied there. And he now has over 10,000 women scholars stretching back to the days of the Prophet Muhammad. And not just quantity, but quality. Some of these women have extraordinary freedoms that for many women across many Muslim societies, they could only imagine. Women riding on horseback or camelback on lecture tours across the Arabian Peninsula. Women bouncing around, going to study with different scholars from Bukhara to Jerusalem to Damascus. Women issuing fatwas, religious opinions, and working as judges. And one woman, my favorite, who was so revered and who taught both men and women, as well as caliphs, Islamic leaders, and other scholars, she was so revered that she used to give her lectures leaning on the tomb of the Prophet Muhammad. And not only that, she would get the best place. She would lean on the head, up at the head. And so these are extraordinary freedoms that have been all but forgotten, certainly in mainstream texts about what constitutes Islamic scholarship.
And one of the many points your book brings out is that Islam, when it came into being, it was much more, I don't want to use the word egalitarian, but sex is mixed, you know, the women mixed with men.
Absolutely.
And then and you point this out through the words of Sheikh Mohammed Akram Nadwi, that in a sense it was after the death of the Prophet where these legal strictures became politicized. And you do a really good job, again, through him and your own really nice writing, of explaining the kind of arc of Islam And in a way, it fills in so many blanks that people have and clears up a lot of assumptions that I think people can relate to. Can you talk about that, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I sort of, you know, talking about, you know, the Prophet's time, Prophet Muhammad's time with him, and you know, talking about, you know, it's very well known his first wife was Khadija, who was his boss, who was 15 years his senior, who ran very successful caravan trading company in Mecca, and who asked him to marry her, and they had a very long and happy relationship. And that sort of strong woman, you can see when you read the hadith or when you look at the Prophet's biographies, he clearly reveres women, and this has been sort of eroded over, you know, in things got much worse for women when the scholars started developing fiqh, jurisprudence, and suddenly, instead of the relatively egalitarian it came out of a 7th century culture where baby girls were being buried alive because women were conceived of as chattel, basically, and you didn't want, you know, girls had absolutely no rights. And so within this context, Islam came in and women could suddenly inherit. Women were seen as people too, rather than something to be inherited. So Islam came in and really radically helped women. But in the 9th and 10th centuries, these medieval scholars were interpreting the Quran and the words of the Prophet of Muhammad, and they were doing it through the lens of being medieval men. And that's when you get a lot of the more problematic and less equal interpretations of Islam. I mean, what's going on now in the Muslim world is incredibly exciting because you have a really muscular Islamic feminist movement where women are going back and reading these basic sources for themselves and saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, it doesn't mean that I am lesser than my husband, you know, we have equal rights. So this is another, you know, you hear about it much less because it doesn't make the headlines that ISIS does, but this is another incredibly exciting and important ferment that we're witnessing right now.
I don't want to laud your book too much, but I'm going to laud it again.
Go ahead. It's fine.
One of the many things I, you know, like about your book is that you the book is written, you know, a year long interview with the Sheikh, but it's not just the Sheikh. You talk to his daughters. You talk to his wife. And one of the many key points revolves around his daughter Sumaya, mm-hmm. right? And the fact that she wants to wear the niqab, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, the Sheikh doesn't necessarily want her to wear it. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, basically, I'm going to do what I want to do. And I think she was all 16 years old. But let me just finish that thought, and that is the Sheikh talks a lot about the politics behind people's choices within the Muslim world, mm-hmm. and how, in a sense, it doesn't necessarily, although it can, represent their faith. For him, faith is everything. Mm-hmm. Ornamentation is sort of whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And so that's why he's often asked about, you know, women, especially about men too, should I dye my hair? Should I wear a skull cap when I pray? All these things that are, in a sense, you could argue how superficial they are, but mm-hmm. ornamentations of the faith. Mm-hmm. If you could just talk about that a little bit, about how women are in there, but also, you know, these other things.
Exactly. I mean, he's really skeptical of everything from, you know, the drive to set up an Islamic state of not, you know, the Islamic state, but, you know, the need for Sharia law, the need, you know, the desperate struggles for people to wear hijab in France or not to wear hijab. He's sort of like, you know, it's all about your internal piety. And in many ways, he reminded me of sort of, you know, Episcopalians or so on, that in many ways he viewed it as a very personal thing. It's between you and God, and politics are beside the point. I think a lot of a lot of his students get very frustrated with this. They're like, look at what's going on all over the Muslim world. One of the most moving moments I see, and they get really frustrated when, you know, he'll sit there in front of an auditorium full of like kind of angry young men, and they'll say, you know, it's terrible what's going on in Iraq. It's terrible what's going on, you know, on the West Bank. And he, as a child of who was, you know, whose parents were old enough to remember partition and of how bloody it was getting an Islamic State in Pakistan, will say, yeah, we've got our Islamic State. It's Pakistan. How's that working out for us? Not so well, huh? And so, you know, he's very skeptical of these kind of outward ornaments, as you say. One of the only things he said that made me think we should print up bumper stickers is, if you've got taqwa, which is God consciousness, you don't need fatwas. So this was my, it's usually not that pithy, but yeah.
I want to get into a little, on a slight tangent, and that is your personal relationship with him.
Mm-hmm.
As you said at the outset, your mother was Jewish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your father was a Quaker, but they were both lapsed,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah.
And I hope I'm not giving away the book in a sense, but one of the threads is, well, you know, and I've been this way too, as somebody who's traveled a lot in the Muslim world and lived there. Well, what's your faith? You know, what are you? People often ask. Mm. And if you say, well, you know, are you going to, you know, you could be a good Muslim, you know that?
Mm-mm.
You know, wink.
Yeah, right, right.
And there's nothing, of course, that's, you know, that's part of living in the world, right? But how were you accepted as a secular feminist New Yorker reading, you know, and actually one of the points you make is that you, in some sense you question your own Orientalism, if, as it were, not whether
very
you,
much.
Yeah. And so if you can just talk about how you were viewed as a kind of an outsider who became a kind of insider for a year.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think he was very gentle on, I mean, he was very hopeful, I suspect, at some part of him that I would convert, but I never got the hard sell from him. I think he took a huge risk in letting me go. One, and it's described in the book, I went back to his hometown where he has set up two madrasas, one for boys, one for girls. And he said, you need to go and speak to the boys' madrasa and Islamic seminary. And I realized in hindsight how very, very brave he was, in a sense, putting his reputation on the line, having this woman traveling without her husband, an American. I did not at that point reveal to the crowd that I had a Jewish mother, because he was already putting himself on the line by people who might criticize him for being too liberal. You know, oh, look, there's Akram. He goes to the West, he goes to Oxford, and suddenly he's importing, you know, Western feminists to talk about building bridges. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't appreciated just how, not dangerous, but how risky it was for him in a way and for his reputation. The thing that we kept, that I kept asking him over and over again was whether he thought I was going to hell. Because piety is so central to his reading of the Quran, he said, you know, look, the central thing is that we have to avoid going to hell, if at all possible. We don't, you know, it's for God to decide. But, and there are many, many Muslims who believe that Jews and Christians and others, you know, you do good works and you will not go into hell. Many readings of the Quran that say that. The Sheikh did not read it that way. You know, I remember one day we were sitting and we were parsing this surah, this particular verse about that was describing the hungry flames of hell and the manacles and the chains and how it was like a lion, And he was reading it, and it seemed to me he was interpreting it very literally, which kind of surprised me, because here is a man who can quote Shakespeare more than I can, who knows, you know, poetry in seven different languages, and who's very alive to nuances and metaphors in language. And I sort of timidly raised my hand and said, you know, these manacles and change, they're metaphorical, right? Sort of slightly nervously. And he said, you know, no, they are absolutely real, and we need to do our best to avoid them. And he thinks I am going to hell unless I convert to be a Muslim. And although he says it very gently and diplomatically,
Well, I want to get into his life a little bit. When you met him, as you said, he can quote poetry. He as a young man, I believe he read Sartre.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And yet he could also quote, although he didn't really know his name, Vince Lombardi.
Yes, yes.
And the other thing he admitted, again, this is why I got to say I love the guy.
Oh, I do too. Yeah.
But he says, you know, who are the Beatles?
Right.
I mean, you know, he didn't really know who the Beatles were.
Right, right.
And yet, on the other hand, he's open to, you know, society and says people, whatever Muslims, wherever they live, should live in that society and absolutely wish for well-being in that society, improve the economy, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
So he was a real, you know, he's a very complex figure.
Absolutely.
And you're allowed, because you have a lot of space here, to dig into those complexities. Yeah. Were you surprised by that? I mean, was he surprised at all by his own forthrightness?
No, I think he very much, I mean, the reason he agreed to do it was, he said, look, Americans and other Westerners, they never hear from the ulama, really. I mean, they hear from the people who are making the headlines, but they don't hear from people, from quietists, from people who are sitting reading their 12th century texts and dispensing wisdom. I mean, so he agreed to do that. And I think he was tremendously open and kind of like, write what you want, you know. He absolutely wasn't fazed by having someone shadowing him. I do think, you know, he went to this really interesting madrasa. You know, when I went, you will know from reporting in Pakistan too. You know, post 9/11, we all trotted up to madrasas in Pakistan where we'd see, you know, that the sort of stereotype of little boys, you know, lined up in lines, rocking back and forth, you know, memorizing the Quran without understanding it too much. He went to a madrasa that was started in the 19th century by Indians who wanted to fuse both the best of Western learning and of Islamic classical learning. So, you know, and Islamic classical learning, certainly after the medieval times, included Aristotle, Plato, rhetoric, all sorts of things that we would see as a classical education ourselves. And, you know, I went there, and this was no madrasa like the maktabs that we had seen, but it was, guys were playing badminton on badminton courts. There was a poetry slam competition every night at the cafe. They were reading Shakespeare and Sartre. So it was a much wider, it was a really, really intellectual place that was producing very, very sort of traditional scholars. It's not that these folks were going to, it's not like Zaytuna Institute up in Berkeley where, you know, there's a real attempt to think about being, you know, Americans and thinking about an American jurisprudence. It was very traditional, but it let the world in a way that I don't think we often think of Islamic education letting the world in.
I'm going to take one question from the audience. The audience is writing questions on cards, and this is a good time to ask this one. Is the Sheikh part of the North Indian Sufi lineage? And where does he situate himself in the mystical scripture fulcrum? Is he a Sufi?
That's a good question. He doesn't admit to being a Sufi, but I think he has Sufiistic tendencies sometimes. No, he loves Sufi poetry and I think respects it, but he is not linked to any particular Sufi lineage at all, explicitly, no. No.
I want to remind people listening at home and watching that this is a Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Carla Power, author of the Pulitzer Prize-nominated book, If the Oceans Were Ink, An Unlikely Friendship and a Journey to the Heart of the Quran. And by the way, If the Oceans Were Ink, that's a reference, takes its wording from the Quran itself, I believe. It's a really poetic passage.
It comes from a passage that I says, if the oceans were ink, you know, the words of our Lord would never run out. And I chose it in part because it was so beautiful, and also in part because it seemed to me to reflect the possibilities and the pluralism of interpretations that I hope to find by studying it. And by talking to him. I mean, one of the most profound things that I came out of the year feeling is that he threw my own tradition into relief. That I went in sort of thinking, you know, not realizing the extent of my own sort of rabid individualism. I remember talking to his daughter Sumaya, and she says, "Yeah, I mean, this whole me business, it starts even with my kids. You know, we go to school, and suddenly you have to do show and tell. Show and tell is like, look what I have." And suddenly, you know, through this anecdote about show and tell, I saw this entire, you know, oh my goodness, this is, you know, a me-centered society, and how different it is to live with people who are really, really God-centered, and everything that they have, they think is a gift from God. That sounds like a cliche, but it really was quite a profound experience.
Well, I referenced Vincent Lombardi earlier, but one of the reasons he glommed onto his philosophy was the idea that people might have the physical capability to do something or other things, but if they don't have will, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. And the Sheikh himself actually is one of the most willful people you'll ever meet. Yeah. And in fact, when he was at university, while his friends were sneaking out to movies, he didn't go out once. Mm-hmm. He would study for 3 days at a time, that sort of thing. And yet, on the other hand, one of the many touching scenes in the book where I believe, tell me if I'm right, where your father died, mm-hmm. and he gave you the poetry, he recited the poetry of Iqbal.
Yeah.
And it's really, really touching. Can you just talk about that?
Yeah, and it's in the book. My dad, right before we met in Pakistan in the early 90s, my father was killed suddenly and violently, and I was living in England at the time and working with the Sheikh at this think tank. And I went into the office the next day to gather my stuff because I was flying back to St. Louis. And I hadn't known this guy. I had only sort of known this guy as the only guy at the office who wasn't freaked out the day that Prince Charles came to visit the office. He was like slightly, you know, aloof and dignified in a way that I hadn't been able to figure out. But I was such a mess. And I walked in and I told him what had happened. And I still remember it was like October in Oxford, and you know the light is burnished, and he stands up next to his desk and just starts reciting in Urdu the words of this philosopher poet Iqbal, an elegy written for his own mother who when she died, and the words are something like, "Who will wait for my letters now? Who will wait for me in the middle of the night when I haven't come home?" And I didn't know what he was saying, but it was this sudden connection, the first of many, of just an electric human connection in another language. He then had to translate it for me. And that, I date the start of our friendship to that moment because, and oddly, it was the most comforting thing that anybody said to me during my grieving period, because it was so basic and big and transcultural. I was like, mm-hmm. "Everybody dies, right? Okay." So it it was a very moving experience.
Well, let me pivot into a question that an audience member asked, and in a way that I thought, as I was reading the book, I thought, wow, I can just see, forgive me for using the C word, conservatives, saying, you know, this guy's an exception to the rule. You know, I mean, you know, nice to meet you, but sorry, sorry, kid. I mean, you know, most of Islam is different, right? So, you know, the audience question is, given the Sheikh's background, do his views accurately represent the Muslim world at large?
I think it's really dangerous to talk about the Muslim world at large. I am highly skeptical. The minute anybody says Islam says or Muslims do, to say that about 1.6 billion people who range from, you know, Pathan tribesmen to, you know, anesthetists in Kansas. I mean, how do you bridge that? I think what's interesting about the Sheikh is his very conservatism. He is absolutely steeped in the classical texts, in a classical tradition, but has allowed him, with it's his knowledge of the text that have allowed him in some cases to find, you know, very liberating solutions, for example, for women, and in other cases, not at all. One of the most profound lessons I learned is there is no spectrum in Islam. I mean, in the first couple months, I sort of ran around trying to figure out, okay, what kind of a sheikh am I studying with? Is he a moderate? Is he a conservative? Is he fundamentalist? Is he a Wahhabi? You know, here he is really liberal on women, and yet at the same time, he's convinced I'm going to hell. Here he is, you know, rewriting the canon on what it means to be an Islamic scholar, and yet, you know, he will not tolerate homosexuality. And I went to see a Cambridge University professor, and he's like, forget it. The first thing you have to realize is there is no spectrum. If you're trying to use Christianity as a default tradition and sort of plot Islam onto that, it's not going to work. There are, you know, Sufis, mystics who are tremendously conservative when it comes to gender issues, and there are literalists who are enormously progressive in some ways. And so I think we have to shuck off our preconceptions of left and right, moderate and conservative, and so on, and really look at the lived reality of various Muslims. So I think the Sheikh is extraordinary in answer to the question, but I think his views are grounded in the text, and he manages to make both progressives angry and traditionalists angry at various points. So, and in that sense, I think he's rather rare in the sense that he has not affiliated himself with a particular school of thought.
One of the things you bring up in the book, it's not a huge point, but it's a point worth, I think, stating now, where he himself says that most is the correct word, Muslims have not read the Quran themselves. And that you alluded to this earlier about people who, hafiz, you call it, if you can memorize the Quran, you get that honorific, you're hafiz. But that, you know, there's a difference between memorization and actually intellectually engaging and interpreting. I thought that was a really important reminder. And so what you have then are, you know, a lot of Muslims don't read the Quran, and a lot of Quranic critics certainly haven't read the Quran.
You mean non-Muslims?
Yeah,
or Muslims?
Non-Muslims, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I mean, in our first lesson, I was like absolutely terrified to tell him because it seemed to me that, like, you know, I've written about Islam and Muslims for, you know, more than 15 years, and to admit at this point in my career not to having read the Quran seemed like, you know, being a tenured literature professor and admitting to having, you know, just skipped Hamlet and Homer, you know, I mean, and so I was tremendously nervous to tell him, and he's like, ah, don't worry, most Muslims don't either. And not only most ordinary Muslims, but the thing I found fascinating was he said, if you look at madrasa curriculums, you know, in the seminaries, Quran just is kind of, you know, an assumption, but if you're a really, you know, ambitious young man, the sort of real positions are usually in law, in jurisprudence, or maybe in Arabic grammar, or in other things. The Quran doesn't get you that far in terms of worldly gigs after you leave the seminary. So that's his argument as to why it's so forgotten.
Well, maybe this is a good time to segue into this question from the audience, and that is, why does Islam get more than its share of negative press in the United States? You write about that from your own personal standpoint in the book, and I think it's relevant to perhaps the answer to this question.
Yeah. I mean, I think the sad thing is you and I are in an event-driven business, and the violent extremists have figured out a way to insert themselves into the headlines, and the vast majority of the rest of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims haven't. You know, it's depressing, but the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads, it is true for all groups. But sadly, there are not too many counter narratives that make it into the news headlines about Islam. There was a recent study that asked people about what the face of various religions was, and because Islam is so diffuse, you know, there's no pope, there's no organized clergy in mainstream Sunni Islam. In Shiism, it's different, but and so, you know, for Catholics, the face of Catholicism was the Pope. Unfortunately, among Americans, the face of Islam was al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS. And you know, it's a really, really difficult problem, I think. I remember pitching about a year ago, I was really excited because it seemed to me that this seminal text had come out. A group of women scholars had gone to verse 434, which is has been referred to as the DNA of patriarchy in the Muslim world. That is the verse in the Quran that has been privileged among many others on gender relations, and it argues that men, in many translations, men have authority over women. And this, you know, when you see, wives having to take a second wife, having to, you know, allow their husbands to take a second wife, it's verse 434. When you see the Saudis saying, oh, every woman is effectively a minor and legally and needs a mahram, a male guardian to let her get, I think, still a passport and a job and education up until recently, then that is verse 434. So this group of Muslim feminists had gone back and analyzed the grammar, the history of the privileging of this verse in Islamic jurisprudence. They had looked at it and they had come up with a book on this, and sort of questioning, and they pointed to lots of other verses in the Quran that describe much more egalitarian relationships between men and women. You know, be a comfort to one another, be helpmates, and all sorts of other verses which were ignored in medieval jurisprudence. And this was the privileged verse. So I got very excited about this book. It seemed to me that this was news, and I went to an editor and I pitched it and I said, you know, this could change gender relations in the Muslim world. You know, there are all these battles being fought as we speak of feminists in various countries trying to change the laws on inheritance and so on. And this would really be grist for their mill. And the editor came back to me and said, yeah, fine, it's a good story, but let's put it in the ideas section. And which was kind of a sweet little backwater relative to the news section. And of course, the irony is, you know, if these women had blown something up, they'd be in the news, you know? So that's the horrible dance we're doing. And I think, you know, I hate to say it, but the media has been complicit in some ways with the outlier violent jihadis, because, you know, ISIS does something horrible and we obligingly stick it on you know, the front of websites or the front page.
Well, I'm going to ask one related question. I'm going to combine a couple questions. One, I believe in your book you say that he, with his salary from Oxford, funds his madrasas. The question was, how much money does his madrasa receive from a Saudi Wahhabi sect?
None.
None. And then the second question is, does the Quran promote violence against non-believers? Now, you get into that, as do a lot of scholars, about, well, at the time, it was complicated. And the prophet saw Jews as allies, and it gets in more complicated than that.
Yeah, I mean, the famous verse of the sword, which extremists of all stripes really like to cite, which says, "Kill the unbelievers where you will find them," is linked to a very specific moment in early Islamic history, when the Muslim armies were way outgunned effectively, and there were many other attempts. You know, Muhammad said, "Can I use violence now? Can I use violence now?" And finally, because there was a breakdown, and the Quraysh, the Meccans, who were attacking them, had gone back on their treaty. That is the specific moment where you can kill the unbelievers. But there are all sorts of other verses in the Quran at other times that say, you know, you believe what you believe, and we'll believe what we'll believe, and we'll go together. I mean, there's even an argument that when Muhammad moved from Mecca to Medina, there's a central moment when, because the tribes in Mecca are so, you know, are treating this young, tiny band of Muslims so badly, and pelting them with garbage and all sorts of other things, and Muhammad's life is actually in danger, they all move to Medina nearby, and which is where the first sort of Islamic community is found. But when the Prophet and his followers move there, there are Jews, there are, you know, there are pagans and so on. And the Prophet, very much for the first few years, thinks there's not that much difference between, you know, monotheists. So the Jews and the Muslims are sort of, there's an argument, and there are some scholars who believe that he didn't see much difference between them. They were all monotheists as opposed to the polytheists back in Mecca. And this later changed, but that sort of happy togetherness does not get much airtime.
I'm going to take a few of these questions and try to combine them. One, this is more a point than a question, is why is there so much surprise about women and Muslim scholars when there are so few women, Christian, Buddhist, etc. scholars? In short, all religions deface the value of women scholars. Another question is related to that. An audience member says, around 2000, I visited a mosque near Boston with a religious education class from our Unitarian church, and we came away thinking Islam discourages questions or inquiry by their followers. Does your experience support this? And I'm guessing, you know, no, but yes.
Maybe. No, I mean, no. No, but yes. I have to say, a lot of the Sheikh's students are absolutely, in the British term, gobsmacked when they come into a class and can ask questions. One of the most dramatic moments in the book came when two of the Sheikh's smartest scholars made him change his mind on child marriage. One of the most painful conversations we kept having over the year was about child marriage, which he refused to condemn in a blanket sense. And these young women went and argued with him. And in the context of a situation where often in many madrasas, you know, you listen and the teacher talks, and speaking back to authority and questioning the professor is just not the done thing. So I think as you say, yes, and not the sheikh, but I think it's a rare thing.
There may be a few people in the audience who have read your book already. As I was reading it, a lot of things came to my mind. One of them was the movie My Dinner with Andre. And I'll say, because that movie, for those of you who are old enough like me, is about two people just, you know, mulling the big questions, but also small questions too. Right. And it's very much funny, but it's also a kind of serious way to kind of, you know, challenge each other.
Right.
And in a way, you were doing that with the sheikh. And he was also doing that with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't, you know, it was the proverbial two-way street. And you did ask about, you know, gays and lesbians, but we have a question from the audience, a member who says, you seem to have skated on the issue of gays and lesbians. I'm gay. I have lots of close Muslim friends. I'd like to know where I stand.
Homosexuality was yet another big departure for both of us, because I kept saying, you know, this is going on. I mean, we were talking during, you know, over the course of the year, you know, gay marriage became legal, and it was obviously very exciting for me. And he said, I am not denying that God gives some folks different urges, but that is a test from God. And the reason, you know, marriage is heterosexual, and that is it. Now, I have to say that's his view, but there's some really exciting things going on in various, in South Africa and here, and in Europe as well, where people are really working on gay theologies in Islam. And I think after Orlando, there were a lot of gay Muslims came out and talked about it. But there are scholars too who are working to see, you know, is there wiggle room here in terms of the texts themselves. So my answer to you would be, just go to the right sheikh and you'll be fine. which is another thing. I mean, that's the thing. People have this sense of, you know, Islam being this strict, brittle, single thing, and like, you know, there is one law. And over again, one of the great surprises was how flexible it can be and how flexible your relationship to Islamic scholarship can be. The sheikh's daughter, the one who defied her dad and started wearing the niqab for a while, at one point wanted to dye her hair. And she asked her father what was his religious opinion on dyeing her hair. And he said, I don't think it's a great idea. And she's like, okay, fine. And she goes down the block and goes to another sheikh who said, no, I have no problem with people dyeing her hair. And she's like, great. And she dyed her hair. So this is kind of like fatwa shopping that you can do if you know.
I'm going to combine a couple questions again. In the book, you talk about the living as a young girl in Muslim-majority countries. Mm. And I believe you were 5 years old in Tehran when you tried on your first chador,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talked about the feeling it gave you, and the in a sense, it was like a multisensory experience for you.
Okay.
And given your the arc of your life, where you did live in Cairo and Kabul and Tehran, granted in fairly privileged circumstances, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Even you talk about your parents were removed, and you asked them in the book, well, how could you not have known that there was, you know, there were these, sort of the underbelly of these Muslim societies were quenching for something else, and you were kind of in this protective bubble. How could you not know?
Right, right.
And then again, in a way, you're talking not only to your parents, but to the reader.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things I really wanted to do in a strain in this book was look at how Westerners have used Islam, the Islamic world. And I did that through my father and my story. My father was a chronic depressive. He was a law professor. And really, the only way he could be happy was either being in San Francisco or in the Islamic world. And so we went abroad for professional reasons, but it really was, he found aesthetically and just in terms of the culture, it helped his depression. And I also think I was really privileged because the era was the 70s, which of course was a incredibly important turning point in certainly in America's relationship with Islamic societies and with the tumult in the Islamic world itself. So my father's Islamic world, I think it was the last time that you could kind of do what Westerners have been doing for the last 200 years, no, more than 200 years, you know, since, I don't know, Queen Elizabeth signed the East India Company tract in 1501 or whatever, that Islamic countries were out there. You know, there was a mysterious Orient and it was other from us. And of course, I came of age, and you know that wasn't true. As you have written in your books, you have that there were Muslims here much earlier than the 60s and 70s, when there really was a mass movement of professionals to America and of factory workers and other less professional jobs in Europe. But I think that change and watching my father's distant Orient become now household words here, and also Islam is us. We are Muslim. It's totally changed in the past 30 years with migration, with technology, mm-hmm. and with a change in demography.
I think we're coming down to the last. Oh no, we have about 5 minutes or so. But this is a really good question from the audience. In the book, you know, it's what the Sheikh is telling you and other people about Islam and its arc and so forth, and how he's living, a Muslim life, a good Muslim life. But the question is, what if anything do you think he learned from you? How did you change his perspective or perspectives?
It was funny because in our last lesson, we met at the Ashmolean, this museum in Oxford, and I was really excited because I was sort of like, you know, all through the year I was kind of like, you know, don't you want to know about what the Beatles are? Don't you want to know, you know, aren't you as curious about me as I am about you? And he wasn't. He was incredibly polite and would always ask after my kids and my husband and my, you know, what I was writing. But there was a self-satisfaction there. And we go to the museum and there's, you know, a Leonardo on the left and a Michelangelo on the right, and we're going through. And I didn't expect him to, you know, sit there and because of course of the Muslim frowning on idols, on depictions of the human form. So I didn't expect him to like sit there and want to stare at a Michelangelo nude with me. But I wanted to know about curiosity. I wanted him to sort of be excited about the aesthetics that we were seeing. We were even in the Islamic wing, and he was very happy to get on with our lesson. And I said, you know, have I changed you? Have I changed you, Sheikh? And he was like, Carla, just to be here, I'm sitting next to you, aren't I? You know, he's like, if the sheikhs, if the guys back at Nadwat al-Ulama, back at his madrasa in Lucknow, could see me sitting next to another man's wife on a, you know, in a museum, they wouldn't believe it. They wouldn't know what to do. So basically, his answer to me in the most polite and diplomatic way was, I'm here, aren't I? I'm talking to you. I'm talking to you about sex and death and marriage and relationships. Like, what is this if it's not your precious pluralism, you know, if it's not your you know, what you want. So that was my answer, and it was extremely humbling. It was the conversation that was the connection.
Another thing I was reminded of as I was reading the book, but I don't mean this in a bad way, is that there was a controversy maybe 10 years ago. European journalist hung out with a man in, I believe, somewhere in Afghanistan, and the book resulted in the bookseller of Kabul.
Oh, right. Right
now,
right.
That was controversial because the bookseller himself, after the book came out, read the book and said, "You have to be kidding me. You've portrayed me in such a negative light. Right. You know, I would never have cooperated with you if I had known what you were going to say." So in a sense, you know, as writers and journalists, the people we interview take a leap of faith with us. And they can do that based on instinct. They can do it these days based on the internet and libraries, like, oh, let me see your work before I even allow you to go near me,
sure.
Right? You had the luxury of, you know, essentially being friends with the Sheikh, right? But he did take a leap of faith to with this project. Now, the book has been published for how long now?
It was April last year.
So April last year, okay.
A year and a
right.
bit.
Plenty of time for people to digest it and say, and finger point. Mm-hmm. Like I would quibble with this chapter. Why you? Mm-hmm. This is unflattering. This is flattering. Mm-hmm. Has he read the book and have mm-hmm. people in elsewhere in the book read it? And what have been their thoughts?
I mean, I was incredibly nervous when I showed it to him, and he liked it a lot. He gives it out when he goes on lecture tours. He gives it out to people, which is really nice. He said, you know, my daughters learned more about me from you than from, and, you know, I continue to be amazed and awed and grateful because he's an intensely private guy. I mean, there wasn't, you know, I come from the land of Oprah, and I kept, you know, it was like pulling teeth often, literally saying, you know, tell me a narrative. Like, what was it like when you were growing up? What was it like? And, you know, the sense of talking about the self. At one point, he's never cranky, but at one point he was like, look, the Prophet Muhammad didn't have to talk about his childhood or what happened in his childhood to be famous. It's like, it's fine. So that whole notion of, I am doing a narrative of you, and you are going to be at the center of it, I suspect made him slightly uncomfortable. But when it came round, and when he saw how it sort of accordion-like opened into all sorts of different issues, he approved, which was a huge relief. So,
do you think he approved of you initially? Let's go back 20 years when you're at Oxford University, right? You're in your 20s, mm-hmm. and you say, you write in the book, and again, you yourself come out in a lot of ways, you admit a lot of things. One of the things you admit to is that, yeah, I wore a short skirt, shorter the better, because I wanted to bring you, I think the way you put it is I wanted to bring the world into this yes. Oxford Center. Now, you might have been in your 20s and saying that. I don't know if you're going to say the same thing now, but what about that? Did he have, you know, a good impression of you, or did you...
I was 24 and I literally, all I knew was the importance of myself and that was it, you know, I think, you know, he was very polite, back then. And I don't know what he thought of me. But I do have to say, you know, I edited less and less about myself as our friendship went on, and he accepted it, you know, so on. He's met, you know, I think he knows that, you know, I am much more liberal than he is, and he accepts it. I think quite literally what worries him is that I'm going to end up in hell. So there's a real mutual respect and fondness. I think one miniskirt is not gonna upset us too much.
But are you? I mean, this may, I'm not trying to be snide with this, but are you worried you're gonna go to hell?
Am I worried I'm gonna go to hell?
after this book, you know, and after getting into spirituality, book. I mean, have you changed that way at all?
I am not worried. I'm not worried. I'm going to go to hell. Not because I'm a particularly good person, but because I have not yet taken that leap of faith to believe in it. Mm-hmm. So no.
So much, I mean, again, one of the many layers of the book that I really thoroughly enjoyed as a parent, especially, is that it's really in some ways about the passing on of knowledge and of love. It's really, it's not just, you know, rote memorization. It's actually fondness and love for your offspring. And for people who are in, who come into your family. They don't have to be blood relations. And in a way, one of the things you make very clearly in this book, and other authors have done this as well, is that Islam breaks down the barriers of tribalism, or has tried to. And for the first time said, we don't care what color you are, what tribe you're in, theoretically, you know, all are welcome. You know, I don't care how much money you have. And so that point is very well made. Do you, and I, growing up myself in a sort of Jewish tribalism, it was one of the things I was really, you know, taken by. But also just the love he has for people.
Yeah, yeah. He's quite extraordinary that way. And I think, again, I think some of his students find, not that they're not loving people themselves, but he is so eager to for everyone to concentrate on their personal piety rather than, say, politics, is very difficult. And some have said, you know, there you are sitting in leafy Oxford. It's fine for you to work on your piety. But, you know, one of the most moving moments was when one of his students, a brilliant young scientist at Cambridge, who came to his Quran classes on weekends, and she was Egyptian, and her brother was in the Muslim Brotherhood, and she was in the Muslim Brotherhood too, because she had decided that in Egypt, the only real opposition, the only real way to make things better, was to join the Brotherhood. And her brother, under Morsi, when there was the coup, when the Brotherhood were in, he was the foreign secretary. And when there was the coup by the military, he was put in solitary confinement and in jail. And I remember her going up to the Sheikh afterwards and saying, "Look, what am I? You keep saying we should just concentrate on our personal piety and doing good things, but you know, what am I supposed to do? Let my brother hang? I, you know." And he said, "You know, it's a test from God." So that kind of frustration from folks who were coming from countries that didn't have the freedoms that he has in the UK, I think was very frustrating for some people.
This may be our last question. I, coming into tonight's talk, I was scanning the headlines. One of them, of course, related to Donald Trump and his. Let that come on. Yeah. But his continuing antagonism toward American Muslims and Muslims in general, and about the fact that he wants to essentially have every Muslim immigrant pledged to a litmus test, kind of a litmus test. The other headline I saw, and again, I'm focused on this because of the talk in my own interest, is that in France, another town has banned the burkini. So, and it's caused quite a controversy there. And in your book, you know, the Sheikh talks about, well, you know, whether you wear a burqa, burkini, he doesn't mention the burkini, but he might as well have, you know, whatever, these are just outward manifestations, and please, you know, within your own homes, you can be as pious as you want to be. And yet, of course, the reality is that people in the article I saw said this is unfair. They're specifically criticizing and punishing Muslims. Mm-hmm. How do you, as a kind of observer who's written this book, who's lived and traveled in the Muslim world, how do you respond or analyze the commotion, if you can call it that, around Muslims and Islam and society now?
I mean, I think it's interesting that you picked up on the veil, which is, you know, has got to be the most written about, most contested flap of fabric in the history of humankind. I mean, and that. It is things like that, or the height of your minaret in Switzerland. It's these very superficial things that become lightning rods for everything else. I mean, and that superficiality is sad. And they often come when you know, what is it? 63% of Americans say they don't know a Muslim. You know, and often the places where there is greatest fear that Sharia law is going to take over, or that, you know, the Muslims are coming, are precisely the places where there are no Muslims in sight. You know, I mean, quite literally. I mean, I live in Britain, where you know, the biggest voters for the anti-migration party are all in places where there are no migrants. So it's this disconnect between knowledge and actually having, I mean, whenever anybody asks me, you know, what can we do to break down these barriers? And my answer is incredibly low tech. It's like, go to a mosque. You know, the sheikh is trying to organize, like, have your neighbor over for dinner things. You know, it's these really, really basic things that are ultimately going to break down these prejudices.
I think it's a really good spot to leave on. Our thanks to Carla Power, author of the Pulitzer Prize nominated book, If the Oceans Were Ink. Paperback copies of her book are on sale that way. To our left, and she will be happy to sign a copy for you. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.